this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence. And for this week's podcast, I want to do it a bit differently. I want to mark the passing of the legendary poet and publisher Lawrence Ferlinghetti, City Lights books, The Beats. It just because he not only was my mentor and friend for 60 years, and I don't want to get bummed out here because he was always a great joy to be with. And, you know, and I won't say the last year under the pandemic, he died when he was 101 years old, you know, but the first 100 years were really lively. And that last year, you know, he had already lost his eyesight. He couldn't read, which was his main passion, couldn't make his daily visits for his espresso injection and conversation at Cafe Trieste or some other North Beach San Francisco cafe. And but the guy, you know, had just was an amazing source of integrity, of commitment, and a life force. And, you know, at the end, in the last couple of years, when San Francisco was gearing up to have celebrate his 100th birthday, there's a street named after him. He's obviously very much identified with the best great bohemian spirit of the city. I had a chance with a British filmmaker, Steve French, who happened to be interested in recording me, and I took him over to see Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And what we captured is a choppy conversation. I talk too much, you know, and all the failings of a cafe conversation. But I think it's in some ways priceless as sort of who Lawrence was. And that when he was, you know, at that point, 99, looking at 100, the life force was there, the clarity, the commitment. And what a life. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, was an anti-sub commander in the Normandy invasion as a young person in World War II, and he witnessed the horrible devastation. He was shifted over to the Asian theater and witnessed the horrible devastation soon after the dropping of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki, and later would say it turned him into a pacifist. And then his whole association with, you know, first of all, on the GI Bill, going to the Sorbonne and getting a doctorate. You know, everybody always thought a beat poet, but the beat poets actually were quite well educated, and he had a great love and understanding of literature, and actually was the most widely circulated beat poet, you know, right up there with Allen Ginsberg. But actually his Coney Island of the Mind and other books had great exposure in the world. And he was just a force in San Francisco, and really a delightful human being in every way. And so, you know, despite the choppy and odd digressions of our conversation, I really like to share it with you. So meet Lawrence and what I consider his incredible life of, I say poetic integrity, but integrity of every sort. So hello, Lawrence.
Hello, my name is Stephen French. As part of our ongoing feature documentary on Robert Scheer, we had the opportunity to conduct an interview with Robert and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. In honor of Lawrence's 100th birthday, we wanted to share the audio recording. These two friends discussed the changing face of San Francisco, being mistakenly involved in the JFK assassination, meeting Castro, and most importantly, the uncompromising spirit of Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and the ambition not to sell out. Special thanks to Cody Moore, Michael and Doug Poor, along with writer and teacher Laurie Talek, whom you will hear occasionally in the recording. This took place at Lawrence's home in late 2018.
I've read everything with Lawrence. I've been around the Beats and the, you know, hippies and everything. And I had an insight today. What anarchism was never really a coherent view of how to seize power and maintain it and make life better for people. What it is a cry for justice, a cry to alleviate pain, a cry of desperation that has expressed itself throughout human history in every culture. There are people who say enough, or this sucks, and they do it more poetically, they do it more energetically, they can do it in the name of religion, you know, they can do it against religion, they can put any political label, but what Lawrence represents is the ultimate uncompromising spirit, not in the sense of some pompous asshole who says, I know the truth and here it is, but of saying, I am a bullshit detector. And I am a bullshit detector whose main concern is that the average person and artists and poets and everybody not get fucked over. But the average person, he's never been an elitist. It's never been high poetry. That's the whole urging of beat poetry, to be urgent, to be accessible, to convey strong emotion, to be uncompromising. That's what the Beats were about. That's what City Lights books were about. Here you have a bookstore. You've deliberately stocked it with the world's literature, all the literature, but all the literature you feel is honest and worthwhile and commands attention, crosses political lines, crosses stylistic lines, crosses religious lines. And then people forget what a bookstore does that Amazon can't do, what a library does, what the modern technology. You go over to that bookshelf, you're looking for the book that somebody told you about, but you see all these other books. And there's a table there and a chair, a couple of chairs. You don't have to buy the book. No one ever got kicked out of City Lights for occupying a chair and not buying a book. No one ever did. Lawrence was hell on wheels on that, you know. And in fact, he didn't say it here, but I could tell you, if somebody couldn't really afford the book, we let them take it, and hopefully they returned it.
Well, you know, when we opened City Lights Bookstore in June 1953, we fell into a storm of politics in North Beach, because North Beach was practically all Italian, and a lot of the Italians were anarchists, Italian anarchists, which was an honorable tradition of being an anarchist.
Yeah.
And the others were Mussolini followers. And then so we opened up City Lights Bookstore right in the center of this whole ferment, and it seemed like all the Italians in North Beach were involved in it. For instance, the garbage truck used to pull up in front, and the garbage man would rush in and buy their anarchist newspapers. We had two anarchist newspapers published in Italy. One was called Humanità Nuova, and the other was, well, I forget what the other one, two anarchist papers in Italian, and the garbage men would come in and get it, and they were part of the mix with what was going on in North Beach. And then it seemed like there was a ready-made ferment of poets and writers and bohemians that hung out in the cafes, in the Cafe Trieste, and that as City Lights became a magnet for the poets. I noticed when I came to town, all the bookstores in town closed at 5 p.m. on Friday, and they didn't open on the weekends. And so there was no place, there was no locus for the literary community to congregate. There was no locus for the community. There was what was called the Berkeley Renaissance, and they were kind of wandering around, from my point of view, out there in the provinces. And
London should have that focus, you know, New York should have that focus. I don't think it has.
Well, there was a bookstore in Paris, because I went there, was what?
You mean Shakespeare and Company?
Shakespeare and Company.
My oldest friend, George Whitman, founded it. It's still going. His daughter, Sylvia, is running it. In London, there was Better Books. Well, Better Books was run by Tony Godwin, who later became an editor-in-chief at Penguin and then was fired by the lord who owned the company.
You know, you just answered a question I've had in my mind for all this time. Why did Penguin publish our Cuba book? First it was Grove Press, and then Penguin, when we added a chapter about the missile crisis.
Yeah.
And they brought out a worldwide edition. That's when the book took off. And it was that guy, Tony Godwin.
Yeah.
Anthony Godwin.
Well, he was fired shortly thereafter.
That's right.
I mean,
and I met him through
Penguin was owned by Lord somebody. And even though Tony was supposed to have a lifetime appointment at Penguin, he was fired for publishing books like the Cuba book.
By the time the book was out with Penguin, I was in a position to make sure it was prominently displayed, because I was a clerk. I didn't have to ask him. I said, you know, I would tell people, come in, yeah, and you might want to buy mine over there, you know, so I can go get some Chinese noodles, you know, with the royalties.
I think that was after you were, when you weren't working there anymore.
No, the book, you got the years a little screwed up, Lawrence. I was there in 63 when Madame New came to San Francisco. I organized a demonstration down at the Sheraton Palace against her from your store.
Yeah.
I put up posters in your store.
Yeah.
And you supported it. And
she wouldn't have posters.
And I think when Kennedy was shot, I was getting my hair cut across the street at some barber shop. And I remember I came in the store and somebody said, the FBI's looking for you, because they say you are a member of an organization that killed the president. It was Fair Play for Cuba. And I said, oh, no, I'm in a group called Students for Fair Play for Cuba. But I remember that. I walked across Columbus, came in, I think Shig or somebody said, hey, the FBI's trying to get a hold of you. You know, and I had to clear that up quickly, that I had not killed the president. But I found a home at City Lights. And that's where I started doing my Vietnam stuff, and then I went to Vietnam and everything, because you got it right away. You were part of a post-World War II generation, at least some of you, that knew even the good war was a horror.
Yeah.
So for me, that was the confirmation,
It was in the 1960s that I realized that. Up to then, I was a good American. I thought the war was wonderful. I was totally politically naive, and I didn't really have any political education until I started listening to Kenneth Rexroth on KPFA FM, the Berkeley station. And I got a complete political education listening to Rexroth's program and also going to his house, where he had he called it a soiree every Friday night, where a lot of the best poets in town showed up. At 250 Scott Street in the old Fillmore District, when the Fillmore District was black. I'm talking about the 1950s. So Rexroth was really very important. He was the most important literary person in San Francisco. And he was a great political critic. You know, he believed in a philosophical anarchism. And at these Friday night soirees at his house, I didn't dare open my mouth for about the first year I went, because he was so far ahead of me. I didn't really have any political education till I started listening to him. The Beat Generation was just Allen Ginsberg.
Really?
There wouldn't have been any without him. He created the whole thing.
Jack Kerouac as well. You know,
he was the right wing of that.
You know, Kerouac didn't hang out in San Francisco very much. He didn't hang out with the other Beats.
Right.
No, he was home taking care of his mother.
I'm really intrigued with the poetry of that time, though, because I tell my students, you know, that here you suddenly see, because we've taught them pre-1900 poetry,
yeah.
You know, the definite meter, a definite rhythm all the time. You know, is it pentameter, is it hectameter, you know, hexameter, and then suddenly you get the poetry of the Beat Generation, you know, and they were completely confused. They're like, where's the meter here? Where's the rhythm? You know,
but in Howl, Ginsberg had his own rhythm. You know, he was a definite rhythm. It wasn't the iambic pentameter, but
can I ask you what made you spread out across the page?
Similar to what was happening in painting, there was a whole field painting. You didn't just use the straight line, you use the whole page. In the case of mine, the topography was very well balanced. The whole page was very well balanced, like a mobile or a painting.
Yeah.
I stole money from Lawrence Ferlinghetti. It's the most shameful
thing I've ever done in my life. But it's like the guy in Paris who stole money. I was hungry, you know.
But you put an IOU.
I did put little IOUs. I didn't make them that prominent. I tucked them in the back of the cash register. And then I tried in good faith to pay back the money. But I have to tell you, it really bothered me. At the end of the day, somewhere or other, he got his money back. But I was hungry. That buck and a quarter, you can't live. I'm going to take them to show them what used to be the hotel. Now it's a boutique hotel, 444 Columbus.
Right.
I was grateful for the job because it's the only job I had and I could read. He let us take home books. You let us take home books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. And as long as we didn't mess them up, you could bring them back and sell them. And then he had, you have to understand, you'll see it when you go to the store, all these great magazines, so that the garbage collector grabbing his anarchist publication was not the only one.
Yeah.
You know, we had the only homosexual literature.
Right.
And that's true, yeah.
Only homosexual, because there was a little guy with a bald head. You remember him? He had the Madison Society.
Yeah.
This is important in the whole gay movement, I tell you. Yeah. The Madison Society was like one of the first. And then we had, who was it? Janae came by the bookstore. Yeah.
What years did you actually work at City Lights?
Well, this is what look, I came out, I know it very clearly because you're one of the first people I went to visit. And you remember my wife Serena, who ended up living in your cabin with Lou Embry, who was one of the poets. Okay, so Serena and I came out on a Greyhound bus to Berkeley to go to, I was going to graduate school, and she went to work at the Oakland Tribune. She was a journalist, one of the first women to go work at this right-wing Republican newspaper, or any paper for that matter. And the first thing we did, we were there by coincidence. We were able to rent a house for $50 a month that Allen Ginsberg had lived in. Wow. We thought we died and gone to heaven.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, wow! How did in Berkeley? How did this happen on Francisco and Milvia? Francisco Street, just above Milvia. Little house, not there anymore, behind another house, a little wooden house. And the next day, we went over to San Francisco to City Lights Books. That was the mecca. Everybody did it. I mean, not everybody, but anybody who's got to had a half a brain. Berkeley was boring. Berkeley had a loyalty oath. Berkeley had an anti-communist purge of its faculty. And most, you know, many of them were gutless. They signed this loyalty oath. And so the action was over at City Lights Books.
You're listening to Sheer Intelligence. My guest is Lawrence Ferlinghetti. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sheer Intelligence. My guest, Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Now I'll ask you a question. When did you write 1,000 Fearful Words for Fidel?
After I came back from Cuba. I was in Cuba in 1960.
But what time in 60? What part of the year?
The very first part of 1960, in January, I was in Cuba.
Okay, so you were ahead of me. So he wrote 1,000 Fearful Words for Fidel. You should understand, the literary publication of the Cuban communist paper, right, on Monday was Lunes de Revolucion. It was the literary page. He was a hero. It was a contradiction. Here is Castro coming in. He's got some authoritarian tendencies there. Part of it was even anti-sexual because their antagonism was that Batista had turned, and the U.S. had turned Havana into a horror house of decadence and everything, okay? He was a good Catholic boy who, you know, was offended by some of this. On the other hand, he was backed by the Revolutionary Directorate students in Havana and so forth, who said, hey, there's this revolution, we're free, free at last. And they had this literary thing. They also had a film industry. And they embraced the Beats as their heroes.
Yeah, they published them in their Monday literary supplement to the big newspaper, Revolution. It was Lunes de Revolution, Monday was their literary edition.
Yeah.
And so when I
Everybody read it, you know, right. People out in the countryside, everywhere. It was not some little publication.
When I arrived in Cuba, I didn't know anybody. I was visiting, I was chasing down my mother's ancestors who were Sephardic Portuguese. And the family had come through the Virgin Islands. And my mother's ancestors filled the graveyard in St. Thomas. My wife Kirby and I went across to Cuba after we were in St. Thomas. We just stopped there. There was no law against stopping there. This is like January 1960. And I stayed in a waterfront dump hotel, and there was two guys at the bar, two young guys. It turned out they were young editors on Lunes de Revolucion. And so I started talking to them, and they said, would you like to meet Fidel? And I said, sure. So they took me to a cafeteria, and Fidel came out of the kitchen smoking a big cigar. He shook my hand, had a very soft handshake. He was very friendly. And he just went out, he shook my hand, and he went out and got in an open Jeep with no guards and drove off by himself, because it was a time of revolutionary euphoria. Yeah. That period was, he could do no wrong. And he was giving huge speeches that lasted 7 or 8 hours in the Plaza de Revolucion. At least once a week, he was giving these huge speeches with thousands of people standing there the whole time listening to him. He was a fascinating speaker.
So you should understand, this is a year after the revolution. Revolution is January 59, okay? All right, so after Lawrence has been there and he's written this 1,000 fearful words for Fidel, which was really an incredibly accurate prediction of what would happen. You know, after all, U.S. policy for the next 3 years was designed to kill Fidel, or actually not this, next 30 years, 50 years, still going on. Yeah. Okay, so you have this contradiction that you have this literary quarterly, which is a hotbed of poets, writers, gay people, everything, all more motivated by the American beats than any other thing. Yeah. And now is their chance, you know, Pablo Armando, Mundo Desnoyes, I forget all their names.
Oh, Pablo Armando Fernandez.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And Mundo Desnoyes, I remember, who was the guy who, the editor of the paper, he took exile in Italy, not Carlos Franchi. We go down there and we check this out, and I was aware of all these contradictions, and I, by then, had already visited City Lights, spent a year in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Come back, and I'm in this place called the Center for Chinese Studies, which is a CIA-connected operation to learn Chinese and be economists. And that's when I get involved here with this guy, Maurice Zeitlin, who is a Latin American specialist and a sociologist who's just getting his doctorate. And we're giving these speeches. He's over there one day, hears the speech, and asks us, would we write a book for him? Which he doesn't publish because he thinks it's too scholarly and too many footnotes. And right? You didn't like it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't like it. But he hooked us up with Grove Press and Penguin, which I learned again today for the first time, the connection.
Well, no, I said, it's not that I didn't like it. I told Bob, he wrote like a graduate student.
City Lights was the Mecca. This I'm not exaggerating. This was for the whole country. You could be sitting there in Toledo, you wanted to get to City. The whole thing, being a clerk at City Lights, was great, because you're like the conductor of Grand Central Station. People will show up, hey, where's Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and where are those books? And, you know, and if they were good looking, oh, yeah, we'll go have a coffee after at the Trieste, and I'll tell you all about it, how it works, you know, and it was great. And, you know, one of them that showed up one day was Bob Dylan, you know, and he was a big, Lawrence challenges the story. My memory of the story is that Bob Dylan came in with these guys from Minnesota that he knew, that I knew, and he said he was looking for Lawrence Ferlinghetti because Lawrence Ferlinghetti was the first person to recognize his talent. He denies it. And he said, as my memory was, it was in Chicago, the Gator Horn, where Odetti used to say.
Gator Horn.
It was in Chicago, and his memory, Dylan told me, was that he was at some poetry readings, long poetry reading. Ferlinghetti was the headliner. His memory was at the end of this very evening when no one was listening, he got up to read his poetry. And then he claimed that Ferlinghetti stood up and said, this kid's the best poet of the night, you should be listening to him. That was his
reading. He wasn't singing.
I'm not getting any younger. You know, my memory's not as good as yours.
I heard him sing at the Gate of Horn in Chicago, and I thought his timing was all off. I said, "That's really weird timing," and it was irregular and slow and fast and. And I didn't realize that he was turned on. He'd been smoking dope, and that's what made his timing all funny. I was so straight, I didn't even know it.
So anyway, they had these different memories, and he has the idea of this guy.
Well, now, what I remember about Bob being at City Lights was every night we'd have a bull session about the Cuban Revolution, and whoever came in, we gave him the whole Fidelista argument. And there was one guy named Vincent McHugh, who had been a New Yorker writer before he moved west, and he was from the 1930s generation, the generation which turned against communism as the intellectuals became more and more disillusioned with Russian communism. And so this is what we couldn't, no matter what we said, Vincent McHugh couldn't see past his prejudice that he'd lived through in the 1930s. There was a book by Arthur Koestler called The God That Failed that delineated all the failings in the way the intellectuals turned against communism.
And because this was the issue, Kennedy, after all, was president soon. Kennedy got to be president. So now it got confused because this is the guy we're supposed to like.
Yeah.
He's a new face thing, and yet he continues this policy, accelerates the policy of planning to attack Cuba and so forth. So it becomes this big hot issue, and then a few later, Vietnam becomes a big issue. Meanwhile, there's a civil rights movement developing very early on. And what I'm trying to explain is, for me, all of my previous education kind of came to a boil at City Lights Books. And the connection with you guys being veterans of actual war, my feeling is that Lawrence he provided safe haven. People would come through who were draft resistors, were quitting the army. I remember this. You know, they would be disturbed about things. Some of them were hostile to the books. Some were angry that we were against the war. I had a fight with a guy downstairs who was pissing on all the books and everything.
Yeah.
And he was a veteran or something, and I had to go down and restrain him and got in a fight, the cops coming, the whole thing. I remember that because there was a guy named Saul Landau who did the San Francisco Mime Troupe and another thing, and he was upstairs and he hears this ruckus, and I'm fighting with this guy on the floor who's pissing on the books, and Saul comes down and I said, "Saul, call the fucking cops." And then Saul says, "You think we should?" You know, because the cops were not supposed to.
We had a policy never to call the cops.
Never call the cops. But I'm the guy is fucking pulling my hair and punching my face. You know, and we are going to call the cops. This guy's crazy. You know, he's going to kill me. You know, so it was that kind of a place. But the thread I want to get back to is, for me, Lawrence represented the true meaning of sophistication. Now, he's going to hate to hear this. But the fact of the matter is, this guy who played like he's just a yokel actually already had a doctorate, understood French literature, had been in a war, had been at Nagasaki after the bombing, dropping the atomic bomb, has seen all this stuff, and yet he's still playing at being naive. You know, just walking his dog, Homer.
I wasn't playing at being naive. I was naive.
Well, not about French literature, not about war and peace.
Well, anarchy was a way to liberate oneself from the military-industrial perplex. That's how it appealed to me. Later on, I realized anarchism could never work because the population of... When anarchism had its strongest day was when there were less than half the number of people on Earth as there are now. So now it's just too many people on Earth to be able to exist without some kind of government. Gradually I evolved, got a long way from anarchism. I became a democratic socialist. Democratic socialism is the future. The younger generation wants socialism. The younger generations in this country. Bernie Sanders made a big mistake. He muted his socialist message when he ran for president. He didn't really get into it, into the theory and practice of socialism. He just tried to be a Democrat.
So let me ask you about getting older, Lawrence, because I'm a protege of yours. These guys are making a film, and, you know, I'm 82 years old. I just interviewed Cy Hirsch on this podcast. He's 81, you know, and the big lesson that I got out of my interview with him and reading his book and all that, the big issue for us goes, and it goes back a lot to the Beats, it's not about anarchism, it's about not selling out.
No. Yeah.
The good thing about an anarchist, it used to be the good thing about a Trotskyist too, I used to say, they had no country that they had to apologize for.
Yeah.
Whatever country was there, that you could count on the Trotskyist to condemn it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why Che Guevara left Fidel. That's why Che Guevara was a Trotskyist, and an anarchist of sorts. And Che Guevara ended up being killed in Bolivia because he was going to continue permanent revolution the same way Trotsky was talking about it. But it all has to do with integrity. Boring word, I know. But if this documentary these guys are making, I don't know, these guys could be the CIA for all I know and fuck us all over, but so what?
I'm a retainer.
Yeah, I'm a retainer, you know. And they work with the Brits all the time, you know. But leaving that aside for a minute, the real thing I would like to get at, and why I'm wasting your time maybe here, is for me, you've been, and I'm not blowing smoke here, a center of integrity. So whether I was stealing money from your cash register or I was denying the logic of your message of 1,000 fearful words for Fidel or your anarchism, you were always trying to figure stuff out in a very principled way. Lawrence, you know, this is my last question. We live in a very changed world. We don't even have bookstores anymore, or very many of them. We don't even have books very much. We don't even know if we're going to have newspapers. And I think if there's any value in having these interviews, there's something about you that I would like to bottle and pass on about integrity. Integrity. Not selling out. And as I recall, the main thing around City Lights and everything was, don't sell out. Don't become like them.
Oh, yeah.
That was the main message.
Oh, yeah. And Shigeyoshi Murao, who was the manager of the bookstore, he was very important in that line because he was someone, his very presence, you got the idea that this is someone who'd never sell out.
But the whole idea was, it wasn't whether you were an anarchist or a socialist. It wasn't that. It was just don't fall for the corporate state, the Madison Avenue, the advertising world.
Yeah.
And now you look at San Francisco, it's the center of that world.
I know.
The center of glibness.
And that horrible Salesforce Tower.
Yeah.
The tallest building in the West. A disgusting building, and they had the nerve of calling the building Salesforce.
Surrounded by homeless people at night.
Yeah.
Huge encampment. All right, Lawrence, you've been very kind, and I think we got it. You know, I mean, the reason I wanted these guys, I mean, they wanted to see you, but I mean, you know, this is the whole turning point of my life. I mean, I was on my way to being an asshole. I was. Anything I can do to improve your circumstance?
No. Nothing can be done about old age.
Tell me about it.
And now an outro. I want to thank Christopher Ho for once again getting our podcast up, sometimes under time pressure, and he does a great job at KCRW, the terrific FM station in Santa Monica. Natasha Hakimi Zapata, who writes the introduction, and Lucy Berbio, who does the transcription. Joshua Shear, who is the producer of Shear Intelligence and runs every aspect of the operation. And I want to particular shout out to the JWK Foundation, which in the memory of a great writer, Gene Stein, helps support these podcasts week after week. So that's it for this edition. See you next week with another Shear Intelligence program.